All right, we need to start this one in Luke chapter 10, actually. So if you'll have your Bible open to the end of Luke chapter 10. And we remember the story of Mary and Martha. And we'll not try to restudy everything that we did last week, but suffice it to say that what we have in this account in Luke chapter 10 is Jesus as a guest in a home that was important in his life. I mean, the home of your dearest friends, the homes that where you're a guest more than once are important to everybody, and that's, I'm certain, the case here as well. Now, the thing that I hope we got from last week is that here are two wonderful, godly women, Mary and Martha, both of whom are paying attention to Jesus in different ways. Now, that's the thing that I want to kind of impress on our minds. It's not that Mary was paying attention to Jesus and Martha wasn't. It's that Martha was choosing to pay attention to Jesus by doing the work, and Mary is paying attention to Jesus by being having her heart open to what she could learn from him. One has the attention fixed on what he is teaching. The other has the attention fixed on what she's doing for him. Now notice the way I've just tried to set that up. It's what he's doing for me versus what I'm doing for him. Those are the two different approaches to this. Now, with Martha, I want to ask again. It's actually number 10 on the paper that we used last week. If you still have that, what principle did Jesus remind Martha of? This would be 11, actually. What principle does Jesus remind Martha of, and how would it have helped her in her aggravation with her sister at that moment? This is 10 on the paper. I'll get my number right in a second.
Not to worry.
All right. The idea is that not to be, remember our words, not to be distracted, anxious, and troubled about all the things that need to be that need to be done. And the principle I'm getting at is verse 42, actually. But one thing is, this version says, necessary. One thing is necessary, or some will say only one thing. What is the principle that the Lord is stating there, and how would it have helped Martha in that setting? The principle is that sometimes in life there are a lot of good things that need to be done or that might be done, but you can't do them all. An old friend of mine who lives in Los Angeles, he talks a real high voice and real slow. He told me one time, "Bill, one fella can only do so much good." His point is that there are moments in life when you can't do everything, and so you have to choose which is most important. Martha was busy doing everything, and it had gotten control of her. And what she was needing to do is to take control of it by determining which was most important. When you've invited Christ into your home, is it more important to pay attention to how he can bless you, or is it more important to pay attention to all the ways the house needs to be kept and all the things that need to be done and all that? That's the principle the Lord reminded her of. Now, can you think of other biblical principles that might have been necessary or might have been helpful in the circumstances that we've read about here? What other Bible principles might have been helpful? And let me add, not just on Martha's part here. Y'all are either having trouble thinking back a week or thinking at all. I'm not sure which way it is. The situation, let me remind us the situation. The Lord's a guest in the house of Martha. Martha welcomes him. Her sister sits down at his feet and listens to his teaching. Martha is distracted with all the things that need to be done, with much serving. So she goes, and you can tell frustration has built up. She goes not to Mary, but to Jesus, and she says, and it's almost a rebuke to Jesus, "Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve alone?" It's obvious in that statement that she has gotten to the point where she feels like, number one, nobody's helping me, and number two, nobody really cares. Okay. So what other principles might have helped? Eddie, I saw your...
Maybe David said it past in Psalms 27:4. "One thing I have desired of the Lord that I will seek, that I will dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, behold the beauty of the Lord, and to inquire in his temple."
All right, that would be the highest one thing that would have been entered the picture. Chatty, what were you going to say?
Another principle might be, as Christians, we're supposed to go to each other first.
All right. It might have been advisable to quietly go to your sister and say, "Mary, I'm a little overloaded here. Could you help me just a second?" That would be one. Speak to the person that you're really frustrated with, not the other one. All right. What else?
Watch his heart. Instead of sacrifice.
All right, the Lord, the idea that the inside is important as well as the outside, we'll see that in the next story, is one reason I want to mention that. And even the golden rule might figure in with this as well. I found a quote in a commentary on Luke, actually by a writer named Norval Geldenhuis. What a name. I don't know anything about this man's background, but I think he makes an interesting observation, important one, that I might be a good way for us to round off this story about Mary and Martha. This man writes, "This story should not be taken to mean that the Savior taught that a life of quiet worship and contemplation is the right form of religion, and that an active Christian life is to be disapproved of." In other words, he's not teaching it's better to sit down and just think than it is to get up and do anything in the Lord's service. He says what we do learn here is that in our life's active service, we must not be anxious and agitated, sulky and dissatisfied with our fellow Christians or our Master, and that we should not busy ourselves to such an extent with outward things that we neglect the quiet worship of the Lord. I think that is the lesson from this story that is helpful for us to know ourselves and to remember that when there are many pressures on you, then you choose. Gordon MacDonald has a little book that he wrote some years back entitled "Ordering Your Private World." And one of the points that he makes in that book is that a person, each one of us, has to know our own inner life and ourselves well enough to be able to do what Jesus is advising here. For example, you have to even know your life and the schedule of your week well enough to know when are your best days to do which things. In my life, I have found out that Thursday and Friday are not my best people days. Would you have any guess as to why? Now, the rest of the story is that Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday aren't either. But Thursday and Friday, why would those 2 days, for me, not be really my best people days? You don't know me well enough.
Getting ready.
All right. I'm one of the guys who, I choose what I'm going to try to help us think about, and I work on it. But I don't put it down until I have to. It's never like I want it. So I can be talking to you and looking you in the eye, and my mind will be on point number two somewhere over here in some corner of the desk. And what Jesus is teaching here is that we are a part of living for Him is paying that kind of attention to what really is going on in our lives. Now, that will be a good contrast to the next story which we want to think about. Luke chapter 11, verses 37 and following, where Jesus is also a guest in a home and where there's also some stress going on in somebody's mind, but it's a really different set of circumstances. The Lord is a guest here in the house of a Pharisee whose name is not given. His role is not given here. He's just one of the Pharisees. The whole tone of the conversation that develops here is has a little bit of edge to it. When you're sitting at somebody's table and you go to pronouncing woes on them, that's not ordinary dinner table conversation. You can probably conceive that if you think about it. Now, why is that? Well, it's interesting to me that Luke mentions three Pharisees into whose home Jesus was invited, apparently by those men. And there is one thing that each of these three visits has in common. I'd like you to take a look at those passages I gave you and see if you can identify what that one thing is. Luke 7:39, 11:38, 14:1. Instead of reading these out loud, I want you to look them over for just a second and draw your conclusion and tell me what you think about that. In each of these three homes, there's one thing that each of the about the way the Lord is treated in each case.
What I see is that they were watching him to see what they could get on him.
All right. Now, Jan said it well. Both of the things you just said is important. Number one, in each case, they're watching him. Well, Mary and Martha were watching him. But in the Pharisee's house, remember the first one over in Luke 7, the guy didn't even give him the common courtesies of a guest in the house. They watch him in order to find fault with him, not to meet his need, but to find fault. And that, have you ever been in a situation like that? Maybe Travis, when was the first time you ever were introduced to Clyde and Robbie and were a guest in their house? Did you ever feel like you were under investigation a little bit?
Still is.
Okay, still is. All right. Have you ever been in a situation where you felt like you were being observed in order to have fault found with you? Brian, have you ever tried out somewhere? as a preacher, have you ever tried out somewhere? Well, you know what we're talking about here. It's not the most comfortable situation for anybody. And in this case, if you'll look at number two on your paper, look at the details that are here that might have had an effect on the tone of the conversation. John, you look at the first one there. Let me know what happens both right before and right after this, verse 16, and then 53 and 54. Coeta, some of you also help with these things. Verse 37, is there any detail there that strikes you? And then verse 38, what are the details here that might explain a little bit why Jesus talks to these folks like he does, or takes the tone he does throughout this passage? What about, John, in verse 16, 53, and 54, in the broader context now of this of the conversation here, at this stage in the Lord's ministry, when you draw the camera back and look at it in a little wider setting, what's going on during this period of the Lord's public ministry?
In 16 it says, they're testing him, seeking from him a sign from heaven. And in 53 and 54, the scribes, Pharisees begin to press him hard and provoke him to speak about many things, lying in wait for him.
All right. Now, this is the time then when they keep trying to test him or to try him or to press him or to find something, lying in wait to find something against him. And Jesus didn't know that, right? He had no idea what they were doing. No, he knew what was going on. You have to bear that in mind in order to understand why he says what he does here. Now, what about in verse 37 with the manner of the invitation itself? Usually when we try to invite someone into our home, we think about what's going on into their life, when it might be convenient for them, when it might actually be a blessing to them. How does it happen here? This strikes me in looking at this as an interesting thing. It sounds like he interrupted while he was teaching. It sounds like the Pharisee, instead of following the line of what he's teaching and listening to it, he interrupts. And now I can't prove that he interrupts, but it says while Jesus was speaking, a Pharisee asked him to dine with him. Didn't say after he had spoken. And that in itself might tell you that Jesus is being invited not for his benefit, but out of the interest of the guy who invited him. All right. Now, verse 38, notice what happens. There's no word exchanged here. It's just...
Like right off the bat, the Pharisees looking for something to get Jesus on.
Yeah, they didn't even get started eating before he had found fault with him. Have any of you ever had anyone say to you, "I'm just shocked"? That's how this Pharisee felt about Jesus. I'm just shocked. I'm just watching. Here you are, a teacher, and you got crowds coming to you, and I'm just shocked. So that leads to the question in verse 40, or maybe verse 38 here to start with. What was the issue about washing before dinner and Jesus' failure to do so that so astonished the Pharisee? I mean, Had Mary not taught Jesus, you know, we wash our hands before we eat our supper? Is that the problem here? Is this a matter of hygiene? All right. These are the points that you have to keep in mind. First, this was not a matter of hygiene. This was a matter of ceremonial cleansing and the ritual type of washings that some of the Jewish groups at the time, the sticklers for the law supposedly would do. And it would involve holding your hands in a certain way and pouring a prescribed amount of water over your hands and letting it run down in a certain way and drip off of your elbow in a certain way. It reminds you a little bit of how
Aaron might wash up before he works on a patient or something. At least on TV, usually the doctor's going around like that. You know, that's the kind of thing that's here. Now, there's a third thing that really is important for you to bear in mind, and this is, this was not something, this kind of washing was not something that the law actually prescribed. Jesus was not transgressing the commandment of the Scriptures. Instead, the practices that had developed here were according to the traditions of the fathers, so to speak. They were like, here was the law, and then here is getting close to the law, and here is a way to keep you from even getting close to breaking the law. And that was what the traditions were about. So their traditions were a huge issue here. Now, why would Jesus deal with this this way? I mean, if this man is a Pharisee, the Pharisees watching him, they're watching for him already. He knows what their traditions are. Why did he not go meet those traditional practices here?
He's still teaching.
He's still teaching, and what needed to be taught? Did the Lord know what's going on in this man's heart? All right. This is germane to the lesson that needed most to be taught. And that's the idea. So when this man is astonished to see that he didn't first wash before dinner, the man apparently didn't say anything, which tells you what? All right, he knew what was in his heart. But the man's real concern was not how to help Jesus do what he should, but how to find fault with what Jesus was doing. Now, I suggest on the paper that the Lord identified one thing as being the foolish matter about his host's attitude. That one thing is in verse 40. What is it? All right, the key factor here is that it is foolish to worry so much about the outside being washed in a certain prescribed way at certain times of the day or certain occasions, and not to have any concern for whether the inside is pure. Now that makes all sense, doesn't it? But the Pharisees at the time had a practice of observing all of these traditional outward rituals without paying much attention to what's going on inside. Now, that practice has only been done by the Pharisees only at that period of time, right? We never would have any tendency to worry about the outside but not the inside. Jesus is not saying that outward behavior is unimportant. What he's getting at is it does not make sense to have so much concern for the outward and to pay no attention to the inward. That's what he's getting at. And notice the application of the principle that the Lord advises is verse 39 and 41. There's a positive and a negative to it. What's the negative? The negative aspect of it. All right. There is a, based on the principle in verse 40, the Lord had a real problem with harboring greed and wickedness on the inside while you are scrubbing the outside of the dish.
It's not your stained glasses that makes your church what it is. It's the light that can shine through.
That's true. I have a coffee cup that is that sometimes gets the treatment of kind of rinsing off the outside and letting the patina grow on the inside. I can kind of appreciate that. You might not if you looked at it. The problem is, a life is not a coffee cup. A life is a situation where you have the inward man being the part that can be renewed day by day, and the inward man being the part that God looks at. God doesn't measure us by outward appearance. Can anybody tell me a story in the Bible where that point was proven? Remember when Samuel got sent to Jesse's house to anoint the next king, and he started with the tallest and the best looking and the most impressive and all of that kind of thing. God doesn't measure us by body shape or wrinkles in our faces or whatever. That's not real living. And that's such an important point to us. Now, on the other hand, what's the positive side of this in verse 41?
If you give from within yourself, then you're continually...
All right. If you will give from within yourself, then the outward cleanliness will take care of itself. If you have real godliness on the inside of you, if you have a genuine humility, respect for God, and devotion to Him in your heart, then you will find yourself treating people right, giving God His place, living right, in other words. So there is a... You notice in this Pharisee's house, there is a point made about how a human being should live that has a lot weightier application than just that circumstance there, doesn't it? And really makes us stop and think, how is the inward man cleansed? How do I give? Giving alms is giving, you know, somebody asked me for a dollar, I may give a dollar or whatever. But a kind word would not only take care of that need, it would also turn it into a blessing. Okay, John?
Don't you think this changed the whole attitude of dinner?
I would imagine so, yes.
Invited to trap him. And
my reading of it is the attitude of the dinner was not so good from the first invite. I don't think the dinner was what was going on from the start, the way it looks to me. But I'm pretty sure that there were some throats being cleared and glances around, and I think that because of verse 45, which we'll get to in a second, but there are people there who felt insulted. Well, that's the rest of the story. Maybe we ought to think about this for a minute. What happens in verses 42 through 44 is, as a result of the fact that the Pharisees' normal practices have contradicted the principle about how life should work that Jesus has laid down in verse 40, Jesus now pronounces directs three woes to the Pharisees. Woe is not a declaration of or a pronouncement of judgment. It's more an expression of grief over where a life is headed. And in this case, with the Pharisees, Jesus directs three woes toward their normal practices. Now, I want for us to describe the behavior that these, each of these woes involve. Look at verse 42. Start with Brendan. Read it out loud for us.
The woe to you, Pharisees, for you pay tithe of mint and rue and every kind of garden herb, and yet disregard justice and the love of God. But these are the things you should have done without neglecting the others.
All right. Now, what's the first woe? What is the behavior of the Pharisee that drew this first expression of sorrow and prediction of loss for the Pharisees?
They're paying their tithes, but they don't pay any attention to other people.
All right. You not only pay your tithes, a tithe was something Old Testament law required. It meant to give a tenth to whatever. Now, to get the lesson, you have to look at what they are paying tithes of, giving a tenth of. What are these things? The tiniest, and you know, some herbs are hard to grow. You have to pay attention to them. The ones mentioned here are ones you can't get rid of. Kay has some kind of, I don't know if it's a spearmint or a lemon mint or something like that. She puts out at the end of our house, and that thing will take over the whole yard. Man. So they are giving. They're so careful to give a tenth of the tiniest and most common of these garden herbs. But what are they not doing?
They're not doing it with love. They're just doing it because they're told.
All right. They are neglecting not only the love of God, but
justice,
the right treatment of other people. Now, what do you call that? When these really crucial matters of existence, the love of God and justice to people, are neglected, while real careful measuring out a tenth on these little garden herbs is being exercised. What do you call that?
Legalism.
What? Legalism. I heard a different thing. Call what?
Legalism.
Hypocrisy. Fred Wilson told me one time, hypocrisy is not having these high goals and just falling short of them. That's, he said, humanity. We all fall short of our best intentions. Hypocrisy is not intending to be what you pretend to be. All right, and I think that's a pretty good... Hypocrisy is not intending to be what you are pretending to be. And these fellows had life out of focus in that way, didn't they? Very much so. Remember that what the Old Testament said is God's not after your tithes or your sacrifices. What's good in His eyes is for you to do justly and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God. That's Micah 6 and verse 8. It's a great verse. And these fellows were ignoring. Now, what about the second woe? Verse 43. Becky, read that one for us.
Woe to you, Pharisees, for you love the front seats in the synagogues and the respectful greetings in the marketplace.
All right, what's the problem with that?
Having your ego's boosted.
All right. Is it wrong for them to appreciate people being kind to them?
It's almost an error of they condemn people if they don't.
All right, it's not being kind to them. It's what Brenda just said. They're getting to the place where they demand this kind of treatment, where they believe they are owed this kind of treatment. You can imagine how it happens. You are someone who undertakes as your life's goal to keep yourself from any breaking of the law and any moral offense in that way. In so doing, your approach is to not to get involved in people's lives and to be a blessing to them, but to avoid making any mistake or making any slip up yourself. As you do that, as you're meticulously careful to tithe mint and rue and all these other plants and to keep all these regulations about washing and all of that, people notice. And as people notice how devoted you are to these matters, what begins to occur? People begin to think, wow, this is a holy person. And remember, you're doing all those things, but you're still a human being. So how do you start feeling about it? You kind of start liking it. You kind of like people thinking that you are something in that way. And then liking it, you begin to seek it. And it kind of gets to the point where you're not doing these things because of the desire to do the right thing, but because you want the best seat in the synagogue. What was the synagogue? Church. All right, it was the gathering. It was the place where they met on the Sabbath for reading of the law and praise to God and so forth. And the greetings in the marketplaces that might have involved not just hello Joe, but Brother Joe. You know, those types of things. Well, we'll have to finish this one next week because I noticed the other classes walking by. Appreciate you guys being with us. Enjoy wintertime in the Ozarks this week.